I think many of us know that France played a role in helping the Americans win the American Revolution. And so I guess it's not surprising, although I didn't realize till I read your book how wildly pro-France the American public was. But I was stunned to find out that President Washington pretty much ignored the treaty that the United States had signed with France during the American Revolution. Tell us about that.
Well, when the French intervened in the American Revolution, that was in 1778, they signed a treaty of amity and commerce. It's the first treaty that the United States signs with a European power. And it, in a sense, it sort of recognizes American independence in a way that it hadn't been recognized before. And French military support is really indispensable to the independence of the United States. It was a largely Franco-American operation. Yorktown was a Franco-American operation. It was the French Navy that blockaded the Chesapeake, that prevented the British Navy from rescuing the besieged fort at Yorktown. So without the French, I think it's fair to say that independence certainly wouldn't have happened then, and maybe it wouldn't have happened at all. And Americans were enormously grateful. They recognized the French support that they had gotten, and they were enormously grateful for this French support after the Revolution. And France was really the closest ally that the United States had for many years, about two decades, I guess, after the end of the war. And in the 1790s, when the French Revolution broke out in 1789, there was enormous popular support for the French Revolution. It seemed to Americans as though the seed that they planted was bearing fruit in Europe, and the most powerful monarchy, the most corrupt monarchy in Europe, was suddenly toppling. And France, the most powerful power in the continent, the greatest power in Europe, really, next to England, of course, but England was off the continent. The greatest power in Europe was suddenly becoming a republic, just the way that the United States had become a republic. And so this was enormously exciting for Americans, and the popular support rose to great heights in the 1790s. And when George Washington was faced with important political decisions about what he was going to do in the face of French and British warfare, he stuck to a policy of neutrality, which was for the French really a betrayal. They had come to the rescue of the United States in the 1770s when the United States was seeking its independence. And now that France and Britain were at war, and the United States was really bound to provide support by its treaty obligations, the George Washington refused. He thought it was best for the United States. He thought it was too dangerous for the United States to risk entering a war between two infinitely greater powers. And he was probably right about that, but it cost him a great deal of his popularity, and it really went against popular opinion in the United States.
The very self-assured ambassador from France to the United States, Genet, was sure that the popular sentiment would overwhelm the president's position. Didn't happen.
That's right. Genet came over in the beginning of 1793, just as France and Great Britain had begun a war against each other, a war that would last most of the next 15 years. And his mission was, in a sense, to consolidate American support for France in this war. And when he arrived instead of going directly to Philadelphia, the capital, he arrived in Charleston, and he got off his ship in Charleston and was subjected to these enormous celebrations where people were just couldn't have been more enthusiastic about France, about Genet, about the Republic. France had just declared itself a republic at this point, and about the war with Britain, which was its former colonial master, and still many bitter feelings among Americans against Great Britain. So Genet was overwhelmed with the pro-French opinion of the United States. And as he made his way to Philadelphia, he thought, mistakenly it would turn out, but he thought that there was nothing that the government could do to counter these wishes, that the government would have to bend itself to the overwhelming popular support for France. And so so when Washington declared his policy of neutrality, Genet, in a sense, tried to go over his head, tried to appeal directly to popular opinion, directly to the American people. And he didn't really understand how the Constitution worked. I mean, the Constitution had only just been written a few years earlier, and he didn't understand the role of the executive of this very new position in diplomacy and in foreign relations. And he thought that Washington would have to accede to the wishes of the people. But in fact, Washington stood firm, and there was still more popularity for Washington than Genet had recognized. People remained grateful to Washington for his role in the revolution. He was the first president, and they trusted him enormously. And so ultimately, Genet failed in his mission, and he alienated public opinion by going against Washington. It was a very foolhardy and reckless diplomacy that he waged, and it didn't work in his favor.
Yeah, I mean, big historic names that we know of, and yet I didn't know about this particular episode. You write so colorfully. Is there a brief part of the book you could read for us so listeners can hear your writing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So this is the very first pages of the book where I give a few snapshots of my French characters who've arrived in Philadelphia and where they seem so I think, wildly out of place. Revolutionary sparks set off by the great explosion in France fly upward. Most fall in Europe. Some, carried west by the trade winds, fall in the Caribbean and set off dry kindling. Others land deep in the North American forests. A few, following the gentle breezes drifting along the American coast, float up the Delaware Bay to Philadelphia. It's just past noon on Thursday, May 22nd, 1794. Médéric Louis Élie Moreau de Saint-Méry, a former revolutionary leader of Paris, walks along a Philadelphia street. He recently fled France along with his family, chased out by threats of arrest and imprisonment, and is now on his way to New York to take a job. The trip takes him through Philadelphia, where he lingers a few days to tour the new capital. Leaving the U.S. House of Representatives, he's on his way to see the presidential mansion when a horse-drawn carriage bears down on him, two seemingly agitated men inside. Moreau is nearsighted and can't see who's in the carriage, but the passengers seem to be waving. As the carriage approaches, one man jumps out and pulls Moreau into a big hug, while the second emerges more gingerly, lifting out his leg. At last, Moreau recognizes them. Bon Albert Briouat de Beaumetz and Charles Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord, two of France's most prominent aristocrats, both from the noblest of French families, and both, like Moreau, former leaders of the French Revolution. All of them have served in the Assemblée Constituante, the legislative body that had governed France from 1789 to 1791, and drafted the first constitution in French history, replacing the system of royal absolutism with constitutional monarchy. What joy, Moreau exclaims, what happiness, what multiplied embraces. Upon their rapturous meeting, the three go to eat. Moreau's enthusiasm is unabated. What a dinner, how many things to tell one another after 2.5 years. What a wealth of detail to hear and to communicate. Afterward, they set off to visit other acquaintances, including Louis-Marie Vicomte de Noailles, another aristocratic Frenchman from one of France's great families, who had also been an early leader of the French Revolution, a constituant or member of the Constituent Assembly, and who, like them, now found himself a refugee in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Thank you.